We to America. How would you have us? As we are, or sinking neath the load we bear? Our eyes fixed forward on a star, or gazing empty at despair? Rising or falling, men or things, with dragging pace or footsteps fleet, strong, willing sinews in your wings, or tightening chains about your feet. Break!
Welcome back to the Black Is Break with yours truly, KC Layman. It's been a long time, but we have a beautiful roundtable in the house tonight. Tonight's guests are Chris, Darius, Leisha, Rasan, and maybe Alicia. And tonight's topic is who can or cannot speak on the Black struggle. And as my eloquent cousin pointed out before we started, I guess we need to define what exactly is the Black struggle. I'm going to put that out there to y'all. What is the Black struggle in 2014?
This is Chris. The Black struggle just seems to be, it's hard to define, but just trying to, you know, survive this world that pretty much has their foot on our backs.
So that means it really hasn't changed?
No.
What is it specifically, though? Or are there any specifics to it?
I'm not sure. I mean, are there specifics to the Black struggle?
Yeah, like are there specific things that we're struggling with? Is it economics? Is it education?
It seems like it's everything.
Is it
social? Seems like we're struggling to try to get enough of us over the hump of low income. We struggle to, I guess, educate ourselves to get to that point. And we seem to struggle to try to keep our relationships and shoot. We struggle to keep our existence going. To me, it's almost like every damn thing. Since you born, you as a Black person, you don't deal with something.
Survival. Yeah. Anybody else have any thoughts?
Yeah, I'll go ahead and speak. This is Rasan. I would say the Black struggle is pretty much, how can I put it? Just everything that we have to deal with in terms of, you know, being here in this country. One thing my dad, he will always share with me ever since I was a kid. He used to always tell me that, like, this system is not designed for us, like us meaning Black people. Like, so when I'm interpreting that now as to, you know, just this whole structure of how can one achieve success in terms of financial success or just really success in terms of being a adequate citizen, human being, just, you know, just trying to live right and do right within society. So everything, I think, you know, from the beginning has been set up to where, you know, our people really wasn't supposed to be at the top. You know, it's everything just, you know, trying to keep us down, you know, as the downtrodden or the low end theory, as Tribe Called Quest would, you know, probably say, you know, that whole concept. So, you know, really, it's just all about, I would say, just our existence here, you know, in this country, in America. But, you know, that leads into other things as to, like, okay, how did all this come about? You know, who created this struggle? You know, why does the struggle even exist? Why do we have to struggle? I mean, because, you know, you take us back thousands of years ago, we weren't struggling. You know, we was on top of this. So how did all this come about? That's what I think is a key question that should probably be addressed, you know, in the future.
Okay. Anyone else want to attempt to define what the Black struggle is before we talk about who can talk about it and who can't talk about it? Okay, so do we all agree that there is some sort of systematic oppression that impacts most of us?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
Yes.
Anybody in disagreement with that? Okay, so let's take that as the definition of what the struggle is. Some systematic oppression that impacts most of us. Who do we give permission to speak about that publicly when it comes to us? Because I feel like we have critics on both sides. If somebody black, for example, Bill Cosby, says something about inequity in regards to the black community, he's heavily criticized all the time. If there is random white person, which for right now I can't think of anybody specifically publicly who has made comments to try to speak on our behalf, but if they were, how would we respond to it? Would that be okay? Who would we give him permission to hold the mic when it comes to this? Who is it okay to do it, and who's not okay to do it? Who will we have a problem with doing this?
To me, it seems like unless you're what they call in the struggle, it seems like once you've quote unquote made it, you can't talk about it anymore. Tonight, when Bill Cosby was young, it was cool. But now that he's an older gentleman and is basically saying things about the black community that as a whole, we're not doing what we could do better. I see a lot of people just like, why don't you shut the hell up? What are you dealing with? When's the last time you had to be, struggle to eat or anything like that? They feel like, well, you've made it. You're rich. You don't know anymore, which to me is kind of fucked up, because I'm like, just because he's like off financially, that doesn't mean people don't look at him and still treat him as like, well, you black. So you kind of got to, you got to step back a little bit.
Yeah, I mean, he's dealt with it at his level, mm-hmm. for sure. In terms of trying to purchase a network, he was blocked from that.
Right. That's just one of the few things that he's dealt with. This is Darius, by the way. But Bill Cosby is very in tune with the black struggle. He lost his son as a result of racism.
His son
was murdered by, a Caucasian male just because he was black in a hate crime. So I'm sure he continues to encounter these issues, but more importantly, I just think we've become so sensitive about the struggle that we don't want to hear anybody express their opinions about it, and we talk amongst each other, but publicly, I mean, who can we say as a people that we are willing to look to, maybe not wholeheartedly, but commit to being a leader of the black community in this day and age? I think we had hoped that Barack Obama would be that, but in the time that's passed since he's been in office, the perception has changed. And so, man, things just look dismal in terms of dealing with the issue when you can't even address the issue. It's like the parent who does not want their child to be chastised or spanked at school, and they don't come around until the child is failing or not graduating. It's an issue when it becomes an issue.
Mm-hmm.
And right. It's scary. It's very scary when one can't look within and take an introspective glance and say, okay, what's wrong with me? What can I do? And I mean this as a people. What can we do to improve? And I'm not talking about handouts. I'm not talking about reparations. I mean, because any amount of reparations is not going to get us up to speed. I mean, when you talk about over 400 years, unless there is a complete stall in what everybody else is doing, we will never catch up. So that's out the window. But I just think we need to think wholeheartedly about what our struggle entails and how we're going to deal with it.
Yeah, this is John Wood, just jumping in here with the team. But, I think that there's a little bit of a difference between who we think should be allowed to speak on the struggle, who we sort of lend credibility to in terms of who has some authority and some perspective to speak on the struggle. And perhaps some of the people who ought to. And what I mean by that is this. I think that within the psychology of the black community, you have a consciousness of the fact that our history within this country, which is the history that we remember, our history in this country is one that is marked and defined by systemic oppression and persecution. And even though I think we've gotten to a point in our contemporary history where so much of what anchors us down has to do with the legacy of that oppression, I do think that we've made great social strides and improvements. Now, the legal system it's still not entirely equitable with respect to the differences, different ways in which drug laws are enforced and so forth, and the double standards there. But we've made strides. The problem is now that we're so used to seeing the black struggle in terms of rising up above the systemic blankets of persecution and oppression that have been put on us, that it's difficult for us to speak of the black struggle, I think, in more optimistic terms, to recognize the fact that we really have made progress, but now it's on us to transition to a place to where I think we can take the reins of economic empowerment, educational empowerment in such a manner to where, on the one hand, we still recognize the inequities that hold us back, but on the other hand, we don't get so trapped within obsessing about these things that we forget to recognize our opportunities, you know? So what you have is, I think, one set of people who will tend to say, well, you know, everything is unequal, the system is corrupt, and we're never going to get a fair shake at playing this game. And another set of people who will sort of make the point that says, well, you know, you can't let any of that stuff hold you down. Stop being defeated. Stop being victimized and this, that, or the other. There's got to be a balance between recognizing the fact that we are starting off behind, but at the same time, we really do have quite a bit of hope for optimism, you know. And that, I think, should be the way that the black struggle is defined contemporaneously, you know. We are always going to be dealing with the legacy of oppression and persecution. But we also have come to a point, thanks to people who came before us, where we've got a whole lot more working in our favor now than we had previously, if we would just recognize that and recognize the fact that the black struggle is no longer simply a struggle against the institutional inequities of the United States of America, but a struggle to realize that we have the power to harness the resources of the United States of America if we harness that educational and that self-motivational faculty within ourselves that would enable us to do so in spite of an oppressive past.
I agree with you, especially about the self-motivational piece. The educational piece is where I would challenge you, just because the system of education is so corrupt and
we bear some responsibility for education as well. You're absolutely right that the system of education is something that, I mean, you can see the legacy of Jim Crow still persists in the educational system.
Clearly.
Because even though we had, you know, Brown versus Board of Education, we had integrated school systems, so on and so forth. But for various reasons, some of them left over from racial structures, some of them for other reasons, but for various reasons, you still basically have a segregated school system for too many of our kids. If you know a child's zip code and if you know the color of their skin, you can determine with something like 80-85% accuracy just how far they're going to go in the private economy, because you know where they're from, you know what kind of schools they have access to, and you don't need to know anything else, you know? So that's certainly a policy argument. But what I was referring to is within the black family structure, particularly, just making sure that we have, I think, the level of focus and emphasis on knowing our own history that can empower us to be able to, I think, take control of our own future, you know? That's one thing. And, you know, comparing ethnic groups along different lines is, you know, a tricky thing. And, you know, every people is different. But that's one thing I admire about a Jewish culture and whatnot, and some other cultures, is that, you know, they really take an active role in teaching their people their history. Now, we've come from a different set of circumstances, but we've got a rich and bountiful history that should strengthen us for our future. But not enough of our young people know that.
Not enough of our older people know it either.
You're absolutely right about that.
And that was a conversation we had earlier actually this week, is whether or not we need to spend more time, honestly, going into our history prior to being enslaved. There's a lot of information in regards to our history as far as Africa is concerned that I think will be really empowering for our youth and for us to know. But I think it's very limiting when all that we know, or as far back as we can go, is the transatlantic slave trade. That starts us at a place of being under, so to speak. And so for a lot of our kids, if we're talking about them not understanding their history, what happens with them is they just automatically disconnect the moment you start to talk to them about the history, because we start that whole started from the bottom, now we here. For a lot of them, they don't see where, I mean, they see the jump, but it's not a major jump. I'm poor. My mama's on drugs. My daddy's not here, you know, whatever the circumstances are. So it's almost as if to be black means I stay at the bottom. I started there and I'm still there. And I think it's necessary that all of us learn a little bit more about who we were before that to educate ourselves and possibly empower ourselves and our kids just in regards to our thinking of who we are. I think our generation might be a little bit more clear, but I think the ones under us, I don't think they have that same foundation. I don't. Mm-hmm. I want to put a question out there. I've always found it interesting, and this has happened to me more than once. When I've been in, well, let me say this. When we talk about our struggle, so to speak, the issue of language often comes to the forefront in regards to how we identify ourselves, what we call ourselves, the names we respond to. So in regards to us using the N-word, in regards to us calling each other, you know, homeboy versus any other male identification, that those things subconsciously have an impact on us. You know, baby girl, homeboy, nigga, whatever term you're using has a subconscious impact on how we think about ourselves and how our youth think about themselves. I've always found it interesting when I've been in the presence of a white person and just how somehow, I don't know how we land on this topic, they tell me how offended they are by the use of the N-word. Like, it offends them to hear us use the term. How do you guys feel about that, just in general? Somebody of another race, and it doesn't necessarily have to be a white person, it could be anybody, but somebody other than us taking offense to a term that we've used, and a lot of us will argue have tried to flip into a term of endearment.
I could understand that, how we feel about that and how they might feel offended by that, you know, the whole use of the language and everything. I do think too, like, if people were to like actually like break down the actual historical definition of where the N-word came from, or nigga, you know, I'm gonna go ahead and say it, the word came from, or it comes from the word Naga, which meant king. So we have a word that's been bastardized based off of just, you know, just the whole process of getting us to the point to where we are. It's just the whole transformation process of taking us from basically a high level, you know, within the world, within the universe, to like really like the downtrodden, like I said before. Same thing with like the difference between, like, you know, we call each other dogs. I mean, you know, I'm guilty of saying that that's my dog, that's my partner, that's my dog right there. But dog spelled backwards is God, you know. And, you know, these words that we use, we just, I think, have to recognize, you know, that when we say something, our words, even our thoughts, you know, when you get into like the whole spiritual aspect of it, you know, they feed us, you know what I'm saying? Just like the foods that we eat. So right. When we say certain things, you know, we're actually like feeding ourselves to be on a certain mental and spiritual frequency. So if we say things, it all goes back to like intent too as well, you know what I'm saying, the intention behind it too. But, you know, I think we do need to be more aware of what we're saying and how we're saying it and the history behind it, you know, because it affects us in ways we don't even see, like on an unseen level. We don't even really see, like, just like the electrical waves, you know what I'm saying, the universe. We don't see these things happening, but, you know, that is definitely happening. Or even the wind, for example. We don't see the wind, but it's a dynamic force within nature. So we just need to be more conscious on different levels, you know.
Yeah, because there's power in language.
Well, I was going to say, I think it's understandable because for a lot of white people, they've been taught this is like a word that you never use. And so I think a discomfort with being in a circumstance where it's being used and accepted could make one feel uncomfortable, because it's sort of like you're a part of the word being used, even though you're not using it. Hmm. But like being in the presence of it being used sort of co-signs a little bit. And mm-hmm. if you're white and you were told never to use that word, then that is uncomfortable. I mean, it would be to me. So
that makes sense.
And then also too, real quick, also we could blame some of this really on hip hop culture, more or less, really, like, I mean, up until that point, everything was somewhat still segregated, but hip hop culture pretty much just like broke the barrier where all people around the world had access to, you know, what went on, you know, in the black community, basically. The black and brown community, you know, because that's how it was birthed. So within that, through the whole the whole inception of hip hop and its transformation throughout the years. You know, it was more or less like a movie being played out where other people were watching it and seeing like, oh, okay. And then once it was widely accepted and became commercial, once it hit the mainstream, I think that's where a lot of this, like, people thinking it's okay to say these things is still coming about. But
I would agree with you. A friend of ours told us, a DJ, he said, once it became a part of the art and the art is just out there in the universe, then you really don't have a hold on it anymore. You can't control it. Yeah. You make it a lyric, people are going to repeat the lyric if they like it, no matter what color they are, you know? And so after that, you no longer have the power to say, well, you can't say this because you've made it a free for all. Yeah.
Yeah. I can see being uncomfortable with the word if you're around it and it's somebody saying it about another race or another person and you're there and you're like, wow, this is really uncomfortable to say. But to me purposely, I don't think white folk are ever going to stop using the word. I think they just use different terms. Like I know now it's thug, you know, when a white person's acts thuggish to some, you know, white person acts thuggish, they don't call him a thug. But if a black kid does something that may seem like it, it's just, it comes out the hip so quick. Like, oh, he's a thug. Like, why?
Yeah, what was the conversation that was happening? It was the meme that was going around. It was Justin Bieber versus
Richard Sherman.
Yeah, Richard Sherman. And Richard Sherman was getting called all kinds of thugs and douchebags and idiots. Mm-hmm. But Bieber, for his reckless behaviors, oh, he's just misguided and this, that, and the third.
I mean, they come up with different, there are different terms to use when a word that stings that bad, they'll just come up with something else. It is weird with the names because I did hear a story going back in history that slave owners would give their slaves these unique names, like calling them king or something, because in their mind, they were the opposite, like calling a big person tiny.
Like that still exists in our community.
Right.
You know.
And so they give them names or something that would be like, or prince or something. You're like, oh, pfft, he's a prince. Okay, I get the joke.
Mm-hmm.
That still goes on. I mean, even got now with the football where they're trying to ban players from saying the N-word on the field, you know, which I personally think that because there's so much uncomfortability with having to deal with the word, with the Riley Cooper saying it and coming out on video with Richard Sherman almost saying it, during his rant, that I think now they're like, well, let's just get rid of it. And I think they just, because it's a word that black people use frequently, that we can use, that a lot of black people use frequently amongst ourselves, and they can't use it. It's like, well, since we can't use it, nobody can use it. We don't like the fact that you can use it and we can't. So now we're just going to try our best to get rid of the word, period.
I have one last question for everybody. Oh, go ahead, Wood.
I was just going to say, I think that everybody, black and white, is pretty confused as to the real objective acceptability of nigga, you know, of the N-word. Because honestly, you have black people who think, it's part of our, it's a part of our culture, and certainly hip hop culture. So to many black people, it's acceptable. To many other black people, it's something that harkens back to the worst eras of our history, and it's something we got to get rid of. To many white people, it's something that's unacceptable and that they've been taught is innately racist and primitive that they should disregard. And to other white people, it's sort of like, well, you know, it's, if the black person uses it, it's okay. They pretty much have ownership of it. And I think the result of that is nobody's really, it's just strictly, I think, contextual or circumstantial as to when it is or is not okay to use the word. It depends both on who you are and who you are around at any particular moment,
mm-hmm,
or any given time. And it just makes for a funny, in that sense, a sort of a comical dynamic. I know my father's a white man. You know, he's always been offended by the word. Because he always considered it as an offense to black people, and he grew up admiring black people. And when black people started referring to themselves in that way, that's something that he just looked at as very strange. Like, you know, he recognizes that this is something that his ancestors did to degrade black people, and it's something that it's a matter of both self-respect for himself and respect for black people is a word he would never entertain. And yet he sees black people referring to themselves in this fashion. And, you know, he's not the type to go around lecturing them about that specifically, but it's very, very difficult thing for him to accept as proper. And my mother's a black woman. She does not approve of the use of the word. She sees it in similar fashions from a black person's perspective. Me, I don't get offended by it if I understand what a person means by it. Yeah, I mean, you know, if I'm in a certain company, you know, it has slipped from my tongue every now and again. I don't give it too much thought. But I also feel like sometimes it gets a bit gratuitous. It's all an emanation of the fact that we are still trying to figure out who we are as a people, really. And that, you know, it's not just the N-word. It's the fact that what we refer to ourselves as generally changes, it seems, from generation to generation. We've had the polls on black is. Are we black? Are we African-American? Ted Hayes, remember I interviewed Ted Hayes, said, no, we are neither. We are the descendants of chattel slaves, something similar to what my brother Darius has said in the past, yeah. I believe, you know. And so, you know, it's just part of us trying to figure out who we are. And that's really the deeper thing. The word is just a reflection of that. And even for white people, our relationship to them and to the rest of the country, it just shows how confusing stuff can be. So, yeah. But at the end of the day, it is a word. And it's important to not, you know, to recognize that words can't break your bones. They can't hurt you if you don't let them, you know.
True.
And you got to keep it in perspective. Because everybody's got a different perspective, and the real issue is how do we treat each other as people, and how do we look at ourselves as Black Americans?
That's true too. I want to bring up a point that Darius mentioned earlier about us looking for a leader or looking towards somebody as being a leader. It seems that historically, what has galvanized us as a community has been a leader or a set of leaders to start some sort of charge that the majority of the community would get behind, and currently we are without that. Are we just in a holding pattern right now as far as it comes to our struggle? Are we just waiting for someone to emerge? Because again, when Obama came to the international stage, I think a lot of us felt that hope factor that he was pushing. And I, for one, in recent conversations, am curious to see what he will do when he is no longer holding the title of President of the United States. I've heard people say that they think at that time he will become somebody who is more of a voice for the people. He just currently in his position realizes how much power he doesn't have. And if he were to speak out on certain things, he would have even less power. But are we in a holding pattern? Are we waiting for somebody right now?
I'd have to argue that not only are we in a holding pattern, but I think we've actually regressed. One of the things my father always preaches is that the integration movement is what killed our culture.
I've heard that too.
And what he means by that is that prior to then, when we had no choice but to support our own businesses and our own people, that's what we did. But once there was an option, and we had fought so long to achieve the right to participate or partake that we just left our own behind.
Mm-hmm.
And so where you may go to a market or, you know, a store in your community, something as simple as that, and support the local grocers. Now you are going to the big chain grocery stores, or where you may have been going to the Baldwin Hills Mall. It's, and I understand why, because the selection is better, but you'd much rather go to Beverly Hills. But it wasn't always that way.
Right. And now with urban planning, you're almost leaving people with no options, because all mom and pop businesses are being swallowed up by lion establishments. And then urban planning is putting businesses that they feel the people will support in areas without ever asking the residents what is it that you want. They just tell you, this is what we're going to give you. And so the people are not really left with any options. It is whatever's here is what's here.
Right. I think, yeah, Target is a good example.
Excellent example.
The distance from this house, within about 4 square miles, you might have 5 or 6 Targets.
And we're about to get another one.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Wow.
And so the number of choices become non-existent.
Right.
Yeah. And a lot of that has to deal with our spending power, you know. You know, they said if we were to actually, like, be galvanized and actually be, like, a true black nation, you know, just, you know, our people have a spending power of so many hundreds of billions of dollars, you know, because that's what we consume every year. You know, I'm a big consumer. You know, I'm pretty sure all of us, we consume certain things heavily. Mm-hmm. You know what I'm saying? That's just, you know, just what we do, you know, but that's really, you know, part of that is that they know that, you know, the money is in the hood, you know, the money is in, it's in the community, it's in the urban areas. That's why the whole gentrification, all that, you know what I'm saying? You see what's going on in Harlem and in Brooklyn and, you know, even here, for example, you know, that's what all that is predicated on. It's just it's so much richness, you know, within ourselves. They know that we're going to spend, you know, we're basically going to spend. And then in regards to leadership, I just feel that, you know, we have to basically, like, lead ourselves, you know, in a sense of, you know, we have to be leaders within ourselves. I think at this point, the only thing we could really, like, worry about is, like, our families and then each other, those of us that's close to each other, you know what I'm saying? And then that will eventually, like, spread, hopefully, you know, to everybody else. But as far as, like, getting behind, like, one particular leader or a group of people, you know, I mean, it's like tried and failed. First of all, like, the so-called leaders that we have now, these are people who, like, have been, like, propped up as leaders. And, you know, we just kind of, like, say, okay, that's our leader. You know what I'm saying?
Or a spokesperson.
Or a so-called spokesperson. You know, certain people, every time something goes down, they're right there at the forefront. You know, it's like, okay, but, yeah, whatever. You know what I'm saying? I think ultimately, you know, we just really have to, like, lead ourselves and know who we are. And then, you know, even in regards to Obama, I think a lot of that kind of, like you just said, you know, regressed us, because it's like, okay, he's here now. You know, we made it to the top and everything is done. But really, if you look at everything that's happened, like, since this man has been in office, things have really, like, kind of, like, in your face, like, this stuff really still exists. Mm-hmm. You know what I'm saying? As far as, like, you know, the level of respect or the disrespect of human life, you know, with the killings of, what, Trayvon Martin, Jordan Davis, all this stuff, Oscar Grant, you know, all these different things, just the whole just overt racism that's out there has happened since this man's been in office. And not no knock on him or anything. I respect him. I love the man, his family, and what they represent. I think the power within that really resides spiritually in terms of looking at that image. You know what I'm saying? Because it's really like a sign to me. I take it as, okay, him and his queen is really like a sign of ancient times. You know what I'm saying? Like how we were thousands of years ago, really. It's like, okay, them being in office, it's like, hey, we ain't been there, done that. It's like, what else can we do? You know, what else can we do at this point but to basically be leaders within ourselves? You know,
yeah.
I hope that kind of, I mean, I'm taking it to other realms.
No, but I get you.
You know what I'm saying? But I'm that's really like how I see this whole the whole phenomenon of this.
But I agree with you that since he's been in office, we do see other people's a lot of people's discomfort with blackness has bubbled to the surface in the most overt way I believe in my lifetime, in terms of people just truly being fearful and not being afraid to display that fear.
Yeah, I think other problem with our leaders getting leadership is a lot of the leaders that we've seen in our history have all been somewhat young, or have all started this at a somewhat young age.
Mm-hmm.
And I think it's on us and the people in the generation before us have somewhat let them down by not giving them the tools they need to take the next step. I always equated it as to when COINTELPRO came and basically chopped the heads off the black leaders. Basically, when you had King, when you had the Panthers, when you had Malcolm X, when you had like a lot of leaders who were willing to stand up, they might not have all had the same voice or agreed on the same things, but it was all one huge movement. And you had the FBI that basically was like, we're going to cut all that. We're going to kill all of them. in a certain amount of time, and then basically you guys can start from scratch again. And there's so that already gives people the fear that, oh, if I speak up, I'm going to die. And
you don't have people that are willing to die for movements like that anymore. You don't.
No. What you said, with the buying power, we have it, but we just don't realize that if we just choose to not spend it at certain places, it would be a big thing.
But we no longer even have the businesses owned by our own people either. That's the other thing. We don't have enough merchants in the community to service everyone. And that leaves us with limited options. I mean, we could, but I feel like we might have had this conversation before. I don't know where a black grocer in Los Angeles is anymore. And I know we used to have a few. I don't know of one. So just in regards to trying to get your basic necessities as far as food is concerned, you find yourself, you know, at the feet of a Lion's establishment.
Yeah, you won't find too many black grocers. And part of that is systemic. Part of that is within us. You know, I've spoken on that. I think we've spoken on this panel here before. To me, one of the reasons why you don't see too terribly well – we have not yet witnessed the emergence of a new class, I think, of bold black leaders who are willing to lead black people and speak particularly to the concerns and the problems of black America, is because we don't really have a unified vision, a holistic vision of what the problem is.
No.
You go back in time, and I understand what Brother Darius was saying with respect to ways in which integration may have had its downsides. I was talking about that with a friend earlier today. You know, there were drawbacks when we had the option suddenly to go outside of our community. We did, and we still do. Of course, more educational opportunities opened up. You had, you know, didn't have the same rapid growth of black businesses within the black community. You did have many more black college graduates. There are ups and downs. On the whole, I think it was beneficial, and certainly on a culture scale. But that's neither here nor there. Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. was able to point to a problem that, you know, whether you are on the militant scale of the black movement for civil rights or whether you're on the more pacifist scale, everybody agreed on. And that's the fact that the legal system in particular and the culture in general, the white-dominated culture in general, were explicitly set up to keep us oppressed and under tow. You know, whereas now, even though we may still observe many of these same elements, because after all, the civil rights movement wasn't that long ago. I mean, that was Martin Luther King Jr. was killed in 1968. We're only talking about 45 years ago. You know, nevertheless, when we talk about the absence of black owned businesses in our community and so forth, that bespeaks a certain level of cultural disunity that you can't, even if you can look back at history for the traces of it, it's something we need to take responsibility for ourselves. But it's difficult to package that into a sentence or a catchphrase to rally people.
No,
to
but
march
I get what you're saying.
And so forth.
I get what you're saying, because that would require that somebody who cares enough about the community is willing to take the risk of creating a business to service said community. And we don't have people that are in that position or who are willing to take that risk. People, and right now we talk community, but we don't necessarily operate like one. Right. Everybody focuses on their individual family's needs versus looking at what the overall community
would need. And so we need black leadership that is, of course, able to do the politicking, because black people are frankly pretty good at politics. We've made a practice of this for a long time on different levels, and now we have a black president in the White House, and in no small degree because of that. But of course, now we need leadership that's not only politically and socially savvy, but economically savvy as well. And you have to go pretty far back in time to find real examples of that. Booker T. Washington is the best example, in my opinion. You could probably identify quickly as a man who both understood the political realities of the black experience and who sought to through subtlety and negotiation and so forth, carve out a real foothold for black people in the early Republican Party in those days. But his other main focus was was in founding institutions like the Tuskegee Institute and different institutions that focused on developing black professionalism and black entrepreneurialism. And what he said was that if you're making money, if you're creating a product that other people have a need for, it almost doesn't matter what the laws are. If they're going to hand you their money for what it is you're doing, then you've got the power. Now, that may be a little simplistic way to sort of paraphrase his sentiments, but the moral holds true today. We need to be able to advocate for our interests in the public realm, but in the private realm, we need to do the sort of things that actually creates the economic foundation for our future success. And that is in and of itself not a simple conversation. It's not as easy as just looking at Target or Walmart and saying, oh, this is bad or that is good, so on and so forth. That's a whole subject matter in and of itself, but it's where we need to focus in addition to these other things if we're going to create a new platform for our progress in the 21st century.
Yeah, it's a lot more complicated than just a general let's not support this particular business in order to try to gain economic strength. It's 10 times more complicated. There's so many things that our community is without in regards to somebody black establishing it. And I don't think we're living in a time set where people value support like that. Like if we're looking back even 20 years to the riots, has it been 20 years since the riots?
Been more than 20 years.
It was a thing to have a black owned business and to support a black owned business. We're not operating in a time where that matters to people anymore. People don't really care.
Well, I think the existence of black businesses have gone down the tube. I know of the one black grocer that was remaining was Mr. White, who owned the Miracle Market on Wilmington and Alondra. And he's a friend of my family, and he spoke for years about refusing to sell out and sell to anyone who wasn't black. As long as he was well, he tried on a regular basis, not so much within his family because the kids that he had were influence by other people, but he did try to bring and put a successor in position that was of color. Mm-hmm. Unfortunately, he developed dementia, and then family got hold of the business and eventually sold to Koreans, you know, which is, it is what it is. But I deal with business owners, black business owners, because there are some black business owners, maybe not grocers, but liquor stores, and they're almost being strong armed to sell. There's a guy who owns a liquor store a block south of Figueroa and Vernon. I think it's called Reggie's Liquor, and he told me that it had gotten so bad to where the potential or prospective buyers would come and just stand in his doorway and wouldn't leave, and he would have to threaten them to the point, you know, pulling guns and saying, get out. Mm-hmm. So after they had made offers to purchase and he had refused, they're just going to stand there and come in and out of his store one by one, walk through, not buy anything, but survey and just be a nuisance.
Right.
Really.
Right.
You know, and it really boils down to bullying. And so we speak about the black struggle, but really there are black struggles.
Yeah.
And I spoke earlier about getting behind a leader, but really with different struggles, you need different leaders.
Yes.
I think on the one hand, certain people who come from humble beginnings may applaud themselves for getting a new car or being able to eat Chinese food. You know, we see it portrayed in the movies. This is making it, you know, I can afford to eat out every day, and not good food. I'm talking about garbage. You know, there is a struggle, but I would have to partially disagree with what Brother Wood has said about us as a people being good in politics, because I think one key to remaining relevant in politics is grooming successors. Sure. And I don't think we look far enough ahead into the future.
I would definitely agree with that.
To understand that in order to maintain power, we have to groom successors who will come into position after we leave. And so while we're not the face of this power, we still have the influence.
Right.
And that's one of the things that's gone out the window. That's the big beef that I have with somebody who Brother Wood is going to be, you know, running against.
But it's true. It's true. When Chris made the point about COINTELPRO, that is what occurred to me. When every single one of these leaders lost their lives, who were their followers? Who were the people who were working behind them to be the next generation to lead? And it's as if there was, I mean, obviously, there was no one there. There was absolutely no one there. And it leaves us in this position. And one of the things I remember recently, a video was put out from Dr. King that hadn't been public before. And he's speaking at a church and he was talking about the fact that with other groups of people who have been oppressed, they all somehow find themselves in a situation where there are land grants deeded to them. There are laws put into place that aid them in developing some sort of economic success.
Oil rights, you name it.
Right. And he was like, the next time we go out to march for something, we're going out for our check. That was his exact line. We're going out for our check. And I think right after that was when it just, that was it. You know what I'm saying? That was it. The moment, because for me, his initial fight was to stop black folks from just being brutalized, just having folks come to your house, pull somebody out your house and string them up for the night. So now the next move is to get economic equality. And we were never able to make those strides at all whatsoever. So it leads us to this place that we are now, kind of all in separate places with different struggles, no leader to handle any of the struggles, and everybody just kind of discombobulated trying to make sense of it all. You know,
I think the one group of people who are consistently supported, whether it be directly or indirectly, are the black ministers. And the concern I've had with for years about getting deeply involved in any black church is that the movement doesn't go beyond building the church, you know. And you look into so many cultures, be it the Hispanic culture, the Korean culture, the Jewish culture, what goes on within the realms of those walls is sure a worshiping, but then you take business deals and you do business with your fellow parishioners. You know, they have empowerment classes and ways of our federations that help you get ahead.
Right.
And, you know, this is my personal experience, but every black church that I've been to, including the one that I've worshipped for years, is, you know, it's just pass the plate, the building fund, the pastor's anniversary is coming up, and I'm like, you know, you can kill that mess with me.
Right.
But
or doing ministry overseas, which is great, but you have a whole lot of folks here.
You have a whole lot of folks here who need to be ministered, and not just on a spiritual level.
Right.
You know, and so when you take your energy and resources and focus them in other places, I have a huge problem with it, which means that it's hard for me to stand behind you as a leader, and it's definitely hard for me to write a check.
Yeah, and it showcases the lack of unity between the black leaders of the black churches. There's competition there versus a desire to work together for the behalf of everybody. It's just whose church is bigger.
Right.
You know, who can retire with the largest congregation.
Right.
Yeah. That's real spill.
Yeah.
I was going to say something in regards to, you know, what Dr. King said, you know, like after you know, the Civil Rights Bill, you know, after he made all the progress that he did, you know, I think he came to a realization that, you know, he felt that, well, his direct quote was, "I feel like I've integrated my people into a burning house." So, like, he was like, "Whoa, okay, you know, I did some stuff, or I helped put in place some stuff that, you know, really, you know, we really, you know, probably didn't really need, you know, because like you said, back in those days when, you know, we really had that foot on our neck, you know, we was kind of doing good, you know, and then, you know,
in hindsight,
right. You know, and then once a few little changes happened and, you know, we felt that we made some, equal progress, which we did to a certain degree. We kind of fell to the wayside. Then on top of that, you know, our leaders were killed, and then it just left a whole generation after that just like misguided. And that's how the whole gang culture and the whole drug culture, you know, in various cities, like, came about, because, you know, it pretty much happened everywhere, you know, in one shape, fashion, or form. So, you know, I think we really need to have some kind of, like, therapy really some individual therapy, like some kind of post-traumatic stress.
Post-traumatic slave disorder,
something, you know. I mean, I think, you know, we really, I mean, we dealing with some psychological stuff, because even like right now, even if we was to really like galvanize our people, I'll be honest with you, and some of these people I really don't even want to be around.
And I mean, that's you know, the general that's consensus. Just,
yeah, it's like,
we wouldn't even know what direction to go in. You could bring everybody together and say, okay, now what we going to do? And you're going to get a million and one answers as to where we should go.
Yeah, you know, we all together, and then we had, just hey, I'm going to go ahead and stick with this Walmart over here, you know, as opposed to being around some of these folks who I'm seeing, because it's not a good look, you know.
Well, I think this is a conversation that's constantly one that will come back to the table year after year, and I guess it'll be a good way for us to track our progress. We thank you for tuning in. As always, you can find us on blackisonline.com, on Twitter at blackisonline, on Facebook at blackismagazine. Feel free to call the hotline at 323-455-4219 or email us at kc@blackisonline.com. And please take the time to leave us a 5-star rating on Stitcher and iTunes. We'd appreciate it. We'll read it on the podcast. Until next time, peace. Thank you.